KALW.
Tell me what you could have eaten off of that last night's main tray.
Nothing.
Lucky you.
Prison meals aren't known for being gourmet, but what about people with serious food allergies?
Migraines, your basic cognitive skills diminished. For me, extreme anxiety.
A new story from Uncuffed. Then we'll hear about some of the challenges that people without housing face in San Francisco.
I had to move to Vallejo. My daughter still went to school in San Francisco.
And a behind-the-scenes look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Marvel went bankrupt, and Ike Perlmutter, who is from the toy industry, comes in and rescues Marvel.
The reign of Marvel Studios. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today we start with a new story from our team at Uncuffed at Solano State Prison. What's the first meal you're planning to eat after you're released from prison? That can be a common question for incarcerated people to hear when they're preparing to come home. For Bruce Grizzle, it takes on extra meaning. That's because he has a rare condition that affects his digestive system, meaning dozens of foods and even more food additives are off the menu. Bruce spoke with Uncuffed producer Brian Mazza about navigating more than 20 years of incarceration with severe allergies.
Okay, so why don't you tell me when this started?
My most strongest memories, probably like 8 years old, I would get a rash all the time. Or I'd get a headache or fatigue or pale face. The bottom side of my lip would be like Professor Clump and it would itch real bad.
And what were you eating back then that was causing these reactions?
Mainly it seemed like it was wheat and for whatever reason, hot dogs. We'd go to the doctor and then sometimes the doctor would say, well, is he taking hot showers? I thought, well, this is kind of odd. How can a hot shower make you have hives like this, you know? But I didn't really know, you know? They would give me that hydrocortisone cream and tetracycline. It's like an antibiotic for skin. I was on that for years before they ran any allergy tests.
As a child, that must have been pretty hard for you.
It stunted my puberty for a long time. So my buddies were growing mustaches and getting hair on their chest and I was lacking way behind on all that stuff. What was the hardest for me was going to school because it kept me from thriving in school. That's where I alienated myself right there. I just stepped back from everybody else because I was so far behind. And I wanted to learn, but my mind was scrambled.
What is a real bad day like for you?
Migraines, your basic cognitive skills diminished. For me, extreme anxiety. Like, I just want to be away from the world. Like, and just being in the world is just so intense, you know. I've been struggling through this whole interview, Brian.
You're lying, because I know people that can't string a sentence together if his life depended on it.
That's you're the way doing I feel well. Most times.
Yeah, you're doing well, man. You are doing well. I asked you to do that food order for me, and there's cake and avocados and all this cheese and cookies
all
and
the
tortillas.
Goodness.
And are you allergic to those items?
Oh, very much so.
Tell me what it's like not to be able to participate in the food sales and whatnot.
You know, actually, it's a lot easier than what people think it is because it's been a part of my life.
Right.
So to not have sodas, to not have cake, donuts, beef jerky, all that good stuff right there. I haven't had it in so long, it doesn't bother me.
I go through this menu that we have. What we had last night, green salad, dressing, poultry, tetrazzini. Now, they say poultry, right? I'm not quite sure what they're talking about. Poultry would be chicken. Turkey.
Yeah.
But they just say poultry. They don't say chicken or turkey. They say poultry.
Poultry, yeah.
Steamed vegetables, which were carrots, red beans. Now, tell me what you could have eaten off of that last night's main tray.
Nothing.
Lucky you.
Lucky me.
In a lot of ways, you're fortunate, Bruce.
You know, I've been told that. Yes.
If you weren't allergic to any of this stuff, would you eat it?
Oh, double portions every day.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not a picky eater. My body forces me to be. In the morning, this is my daily meals for years here. I have grits, just plain raw grits from the medical special diet. Oh, for lunchtime, so I just make me some rice, salt and pepper, and sometimes an occasional can of chicken, maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks, because the chicken has a lot of additives and preservatives in it that set me back, hurt me pretty bad. So it takes me a week or so to get over one can of chicken. So anyway, so I normally just have some rice, salt and pepper, maybe literally 12 to 14 spoonfuls of rice for lunch and a couple milks. Then the dinner time, that's where my big meal comes in. I eat probably 6-7 ounces of the refried beans with a big fat layer of Fritos corn chips and then a nice layer of white rice on top of that with some salt and pepper. That's my daily meal right there for the last, I don't know how many years, man.
What do you plan on eating when you get out? What's your fantasy meal?
It's going to be chicken thigh with rib meat because it's got some fat on it. I'm going to have some pinto beans and some provolone cheese in there melted in it with some brown rice, white rice mix, fried a little bit, a little crispy with some canola oil and a big glass of ice milk is going to be my go-to meals right there.
You know, this might sound like a cliche, but suffering builds character.
Yes, it has. It has.
And this nightmare that you've lived through here in prison has probably built up a pretty thick armor around you for when you get out, you'll be able to withstand just about anything.
I feel very good about that thought and saying right there, because I know I've struggled in the past on the streets through certain things, and I think about anything now, what I've been through in here.
Petty.
Man, like, bring it on. I'm so ready for this, you know? This is like nothing. So I'm ready, yeah.
That was Bruce Grizzle speaking with Brian Mazza, a producer at the Uncuffed program in Solano State Prison. Our work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability, and all content is approved by an information officer. You can hear more by subscribing to Uncuffed on your podcast player. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Next up, we wanted to share an excerpt from a town hall we had at our pop-up event space at 220 Montgomery last fall. It was looking at the issue of homelessness in San Francisco. For the panel, we invited the director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing, Shireen McSpadden, San Francisco District 8 Supervisor Rafael Mandelbaum, Madison Alvarado, who reports on housing and homelessness for the San Francisco Public Press, and Mercedes Bullock, a peer organizer organizer with the Coalition on Homelessness. The conversation was hosted by KELW executive producer Ben Trefney, and he began by asking the panelists and then the participants about personal experiences that brought them to the event. In this excerpt, we start with a story from an audience member.
My name is James. And to be honest, I haven't been able to get into a shelter. I mean, I've been to a couple of shelters and they say that there's no beds available. And for some reason, it's just been really difficult for me to get the help that I need. And it's like my situation personally is I lived in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, an apartment that I couldn't really afford. And my issue was with people, I mean, drugs out on the streets, you not being able to focus because I couldn't close my window, you know, bad landlords, you know, just not taking care of the place. And it's like, I ended up just not being able to afford it and I got evicted. And now it's like, you know, I'm just struggling just to get by, you know, it's like I have to be on the street, have to do things maybe I really wouldn't normally do, like just to have a place to sleep. And it's just not. It's not, I mean, what I think that more needs to be done. I really do.
Thank you so much, James. Appreciate it. So you've been trying to get a shelter bed and you've not been able to. So what would you suggest for him? What steps does he need to take?
Yeah, so one of the things our organization has been working on is basically a resource guide to kind of show all the different pathways to shelter for groups, whether you're an adult, you're a family, or you are a transitional aged youth, which basically usually is people aged like 18 to 25. And in setting out to do that guide, we realized that it's really hard. There are a lot of different pathways and it's really hard to do that. I referenced earlier that hotline that you can call where you're supposed to be able to request shelter, but a lot of the time technological difficulties get in the way. I know the city also recently launched an online wait list for folks, but I checked this morning and that list has 417 people on it. So it's a long wait, right? And in the meantime, there are people like you who are trying to get into those shelters. And so it's complicated. You know, there is a walk-up shelter that people are supposed to, you know, potentially be able to walk up to, but a lot of the time those beds are full. So I'd be happy to give you a printout of the guide that we worked on. But I think in putting that together, what we really realized is I think there's this idea that you can get into shelter if you're just looking for it. And that just has not been the reality. I hope you are able to access shelter. Yeah.
Thank you for that. This is Madison Alvarado. Shireen, I'm wondering, as you hear from somebody like James, who's living this very difficult moment, and you're in charge of homeless services in the city, it obviously must break your heart. And also at the same time, what would you suggest? What should he do?
Yeah, well, James, I mean, we can talk afterward if that's, well, I'm leaving, but I'll give you my contact information and we can talk. But it's true. We have about a 92-93% take-up rate in our shelters right now, which means we have very little vacancy. We keep a little bit of vacancy for emergencies. And, you know, every day we're focusing on housing people who come out of hospital. Because obviously, you know, they come out of hospital and
most vulnerable population.
Most vulnerable population. Certainly focus on people in the cash assistance program who need housing, and that's a number of our beds every day. And then the Healthy Streets Operations Center and homeless outreach teams have beds, and that's where a lot of the beds end up going each day. We have new shelters coming online this year, but you know, we don't have as much shelter as we need. And we really don't. That is true.
Thank you.
One other thing that we have started to do, or we've been doing, but we're really starting to ramp up, is for people who are in our coordinated entry system who've already gone through the process of getting ready for housing, is we're moving people directly off the street and into permanent housing, because actually people don't necessarily need to go to shelter before housing. And we do have some vacancies in our permanent supportive housing, although we'll probably be out of those within the next within the next 2 to 3 months, but we're really trying to focus on getting people into those so that we don't, you know, so that we're using all avenues that we have.
And that's something that the Coalition on Homelessness has recently released a report about. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that process works and what this Coalition on Homelessness' stance is on that, Mercedes.
Sure. I went through coordinated entry. I had a traumatic story, and I still didn't. You have to, like, assess highly in order to get services quickly.
And when you say assess, it's like coordinated entry,
you'd have to be, like, halfway dead to kind
of
get help.
You have to be one of the most vulnerable populations.
Exactly.
Right? Yes.
But it's kind of hard to say what a vulnerable situation is, you know? And I don't completely put that on coordinated. It's great staff, you know, that are there. It's just not working. You know what I mean? It's one system. You have to go there. You have to get assessed. You have to get a specific number on your assessment to get a certain type of resource, shelter, permanent supportive housing, a subsidy. I went there and I didn't really get much help there. I did get connected with other community partners like Homeless Prenatal, that I was able to get a 2-year subsidy.
That was Mercedes Bullock, a peer organizer with the Coalition on Homelessness, in a panel discussion with Madison Alvarado, reporter for the San Francisco Public Press, and Shireen McSpadden, director of the Department of Homelessness and Supportive Housing. You can hear the rest of that conversation at KALW.org, and stay tuned tomorrow for a follow-up conversation about housing in the city. And we've got more events coming up at our pop-up space downtown, but only for another month. Make sure to check out the list of events at KALW.org/220Montgomery. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. In 2008, Marvel Studios released their first film, Iron Man. And at the end of that movie, there is an after-credits scene between Tony Stark and Agent Nick Fury, and it alluded to something big coming.
Who the hell are you?
Nick Fury, director of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh.
I'm here to talk to you about the Avenger Initiative.
That scene teased the beginning of Marvel's cinematic universe. Today, it's one of the top-grossing media franchises of all time. Oakland author Joanna Robinson co-wrote the New York Times bestseller MCU, The Reign of Marvel Studios. It's an unauthorized, behind-the-scenes look at the franchise, and it covers a range of Marvel history, from celebrity interviews to stories of executives fighting for creative control. KLW's Janae Darden spoke with Joanna.
Joanna, welcome.
Oh my gosh, thanks for having me.
How did this book come about?
Yeah, it was 2019 and a little independent film called Avengers Endgame came out. And yeah, just tiny little film, you might have caught it. And I was covering Game of Thrones in a pretty serious way at the time. And that also wrapped up right around the same time. And so the publisher of this book, Norton, they called me and they said, hey, do you want to write a book about Game of Thrones? And I said, no, thank you. It was just like too soon, too much, too complicated. And they said, well, what about this Marvel thing? And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And I had written a cover story for Vanity Fair about Marvel Studios, which is how I wound up on the set of Avengers Endgame, et cetera. And yeah, and so I was like, oh, that's really interesting. But the big question was, what is Disney going to say? Because Disney owns Marvel Studios, and they do not particularly appreciate people knowing how the sausage gets made, is how we like to put it, behind the scenes. They don't really love having those stories out there that they aren't in full control of. So I called up the folks at the studio, and at first they said, don't worry about it. Sure, go ahead. We're not going to help you, but don't worry about it. It's fine. And then later we found out that they were telling people not to talk to us. And so it becomes this sort of battle of how do we tell this book about this very powerful studio when its even more powerful parent company, Disney, doesn't want us to tell the story or write the book. I mean, that's why it took us nearly 5 years to write it, because then it just became a much longer process of trying to get the full story. And, you know, we wound up talking to over 100 people, tons of people, and really feel like we got all angles of the story, but it was more complicated than we initially thought it was going to be.
So Disney would pump the brakes on the project, and but you still end up interviewing over 100 people for this book. How were you able to get around doing that? How were you able to get around Disney to create this book, to write this book?
Yeah, a lot of people, some of the people that we talked to were people who worked early in Marvel Studios, and so they no longer work there. And so they feel a little freer to talk to us because they're no longer, you know, Disney isn't their boss anymore. Some people talk to us off the record, on background. And then we got, you know, a number of interviews done before Disney sort of put their foot down. So that was all part of it. And when you see quotes from some of the major actors in the films, or Kevin Feige, who's the head of Marvel Studios, when you see those quotes in there, those, a lot of those were quotes I got while working on that cover story for Vanity Fair. Because when you work on a magazine story, you talk to these people for hours and hours and hours, and then maybe like one or two lines make it into the story, and you have all this like great material sitting there just collecting dust on the shelf. And so, you know, I got to talk to Kevin Feige, the head of the studio, in his office for a couple hours, and there was all this juicy stuff that he said about his process and about all this stuff that hadn't gone into the magazine article. So I was able to put it into the book.
I was surprised too that he, when I read in your book, that he had applied to my alma mater, USC film school, six times before he got accepted. And I was like, wow. I was wondering, like, what does USC think that it took them, you know, that long to accept him? And look what he's done with Marvel. But another influential person you and your co-authors write about in the book is Ike Perlmutter. He was the chair and CEO of Marvel Entertainment. Tell us briefly, how did he help Marvel and impact the franchise? Did he? I know he was laid off earlier than in 2023. How did he hurt the franchise, arguably?
So when you start at the beginning of his time with Marvel, he's the hero. He comes in and rescues Marvel from bankruptcy in the 90s. So he's the hero who swoops in and saves Marvel back when Marvel was, if you can believe it, Marvel went bankrupt. And right. Ike Perlmutter, who is a toy from the toy industry, comes in and rescues Marvel. But he then applies that toy mentality to everything he does going forward. And he's very careful with the finances at Marvel, which is kind of understandable if you come from if you start from a bankruptcy position. But his disinterest in spending any money ever became a hardship, even when the movies were doing really well. His inability to think outside sort of, I would say, regressive ideas of who can be a hero. When he's thinking of a toy mentality, he thinks who can sell action figures. And in his mind, who can sell action figures are like white guys named Chris, right? And so in his mind, we should not make movies that don't star white guys named Chris.
So if the motivation in the early stages was, when he stepped in, okay, how do we sell action figures? What's the motivation now when they create projects?
I mean, there's merch is always going to be on everyone's minds, right? Like merchandise is always going to be something that they're thinking of, but they're not quite locked into the, this has to sell action figures, because they're thinking bigger. They just want the audience to be as big, you know, from a cynical money-making point of view, they want the most number of people to buy into the Marvel Cinematic Universe so that those people will then be excited to go to, like, let's say, Avengers Campus at Disneyland, or on an Avengers-themed cruise on Disney Cruises. Like, it's so much bigger than action figures now in terms of all the extra ways they can make money outside of the films themselves. In a less cynical way, and in the way that I care about, it matters who we see playing heroes on the big screen or in our TVs at home or in our on the pages of our comic books. It really matters. It matters personally to me that, like, young women or people of color can go to the movies and see a hero that looks like them. There is so much cultural power in that, and it shapes things in a way that I think people don't even fully understand how much growing up seeing that can change a kid's idea of who they're allowed to be in the world. And so for that reason, people brush off superhero cinema sometimes as frivolous or dumb popcorn entertainment. And I'm like, it can be, but it also runs really deep because these are the stories we show kids and these are the stories that show them who they could be in the world. And so then it matters. Ultimately, our book is about, it matters who decides what those heroes get to look like. Because ultimately, they're pulling bigger strings than you think they are.
That was Joanna Robinson, author of the book MCU, The Reign of Marvel Studios, speaking with KLW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel, and they spoke about a lot more. You can find their whole conversation at klw.org/crosscurrents. Today's Cross Currents team includes Pat McMahon, Molly Blair Salyer, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shireen Hadid, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.